It's a pleasure to be here, and also an honor, given that this is the Hyman P. Minsky Conference. Someone obviously who has inspired some of my work in the past, and also inspired some of the things, my analysis of the Cyprus crisis, which is the book that I wrote, the diary of the Euro crisis in Cyprus, about the events there. Now, what I'm going to do now is perhaps going to be a little bit surprising. I don't know how to change the slide. First, I need to sort of... Partly because when people talk about reform of the euro going forward, they sort of talk about the incomplete architecture, right? And on the financial side, the incomplete architecture, there's an obvious pillar missing in the banking union, and that's EDIS, that's European Deposit Insurance Scheme. And that is true, and that's sort of caught up in all the political discussions and controversy between Germany and France about risk reduction and risk sharing. And all of that has to do with, well, Germany says NPLs are too high, we can't do that yet, etc., while France is pushing for more risk sharing. And interestingly, I mean, the Eurobarometer shows actually that the euro's approval has diminished more than anywhere else in France and Germany in the last year, as the 2018 Eurobarometer. So that's quite an interesting background to that. I'm not going to talk about that. There's also a lot of discussion about what to do with on the fiscal side, right, for risk sharing. The IMF has proposed a rainy day fund. It seems like a reasonable way to go. The Commission has made other proposals about creating some sort of fund at the federal European level, including a finance ministry at the European level. That was Juncker's proposals, but nothing really has happened. And then we have the Franco-German economics proposals, which is a very nice sort of attempt to break a deadlock by making some comprehensive sort of suggestions to address everything. But I'm not sure where that's going anyway, but it's good that we have that. Now, what I want to do is different. Why? Because partly because I've been involved in, you know, I've experienced the crisis firsthand. And sort of those insights that I got from that suggest to me that the current architecture actually is not working, right? There are things in the architecture that have been eroded. In fact, it's not even the architecture, it's the engineering side of things. The architecture is there, but the enforcement of it isn't happening. And I think that touches on the point that Dimitri mentioned about sort of the effectiveness of the Commission to uphold the treaties. And that's partly it's been the problem under two commissions and two Commission presidents, Barroso and Juncker, both EPP sort of key people, the European People's Party, right? And I think there's a lot of politicking, game playing there in the Commission that, if anything, has meant that we've gone backwards in terms of making sure that the architecture, the planning, right, is actually working. But I'm going to focus on the central bank's independence and related sort of aspects. So the first thing to note, well, there were a lot of people who were sort of predicting the demise of the euro at the peak of the crisis, and they were proven wrong, including some Nobel Prize winners on this side of the Atlantic, and they were saying that, well, Greece should leave the euro temporarily, permanently, whatnot, etc. It's not working. It hasn't happened. So the euro is still here. It's intact, right? And if anything, in fact, the approval ratings have been going up. In fact, in the crisis countries, if you look at Ireland has the highest, the euro has the highest approval rating in Ireland, which is, I think, plus. But not so in Cyprus. Cyprus has one of the lowest euro approval ratings, right? I think Lithuania is the lowest. What is striking now, I mean, when I left the Central Bank of Cyprus, and I did do it by sort of stepping wasn't just the political pressure, it was the legal changes that they made, right? I'm going to talk a little bit about that, about the importance of boards, right? The importance of boards. It's not just the governors. It's not just what you have for the governors. It's also the importance of boards. And you are beginning to see this now in the United States, right, with President Trump. But it started happening in Cyprus in 2013, right? It wasn't. It's not just four governors. Four governors have resigned, right, or have been effectively forced out of office. Now that's 19 countries. It's like going to a quarter of them, right? It's a trend. And the question also that you need to ask is, what are the others doing in terms of their behavior when they see this? Are they not more inclined to conform, right, with the government's wishes? If they see this, if they want to stay until the end of their term. So it's not just who resigned, it's also what this means for the behavior of others. And I can talk about the behavior of Italy when it comes to not deciding not to bail in the creditors, the so-called retail investors in the two banks that failed years ago, but I'm not covering this now. So what we've seen also, and I don't have the numbers, but I think it's a worthwhile exercise, we have the appointment, excuse the expression, but there's no other way to express that, the cronies on the central bank boards, right? Cronies and commissars, I would also add, and I've seen that, commissars, right? People would just go to political party meetings and then come to the central bank and actually say that, this is what we discussed in the meeting with the leader of my party, and this is important, this is what we have to do, right? And it's just so open and blatant. And these central banks are meant to be independent, right? On top of that, the erosion that we've seen, and that's like the last year and a half, it's all the numerous money laundering scandals. It's not just one or two. It's a lot of them, right? And there's something systemically wrong there. And all the proposals about improving the architecture have not yet touched that. And there's a very good reason why we've seen that. Because we created the banking union, we created the SSM, the single supervisory mechanism in Europe, and we excluded the supervision of anti-money laundering, counter-financing of terrorism from the SSM. That has remained in the hands of national regulators, and that's a big weakness there. ECB itself has struggled because of all the non-standard measures and the QE, but also doing whatever it takes meant that it faced a lot of political objection and legal objections from within Germany in particular. Although it has withstood those legal tests, nevertheless, they have created a climate of questioning of the ECB, and I think that's partly what probably explains the decline of the euro's popularity in Germany itself, which I think is very worrying, actually, for the next 5 years. Right. Why? We want to dig a little bit further into that. Why have we seen that independence of central banks been eroded? Now, I can tell you about Cyprus and Slovenia. It's sort of a no-brainer in some sense. We bailed in investors, right, in the banks. We even bailed in depositors in Cyprus, right? And in Slovenia, they bailed in bondholders, etc. And it's this so-called, and bail-in, of course, was introduced to make too big to fail, to address too big to fail, and to make sure there's fair burden sharing and all the rest of it. But when it comes to the political context, I see very little support for the taxpayer. I see a lot of support for those guys who lose money when a bank fails, right? And that's how the political systems tend to be geared. And so these guys organize themselves or have levers anyway on the political system, right? Another commonality between Cyprus and Slovenia is both central banks have both supervision and resolution responsibilities, both. And that happens actually in 10 out of 19 euro area central banks. Although at the European level, we have created separation of supervision from resolution, which makes huge sense, that's what you need to have. There's potentially a lot of conflicts there. At the national level, this hasn't happened. Greece is one of them, right? Italy, I believe, is another one. And Netherlands is another one, where resolution and supervision is within the central bank. Also Cyprus, Slovenia, and quite a few others. Now, Latvia is slightly different, and we've seen the money laundering sort of scandals, the ABLV action by FinCEN, and all the rest of it. And we don't really know. It's not. I don't really personally have a lot of information on what happened. If this was related to Ilmar Rimsevic sort of forcing out of office. They never sacked him, but they just forced him out of office by basically detaining him over a weekend, and then the judge released him, saying, yes, I'm releasing you, but the conditions is that you don't go to your office in the central bank. You don't go to Frankfurt, right? So they never sacked him, but effectively they have removed him from office over a weekend, right? And this is, there's a treaty there which says, you know, this independence of the governors, it's so sacrosanct. And it took like several months before the ECB decided what to do. And of course they did the right thing. They went to the European Court, right? And the European Court basically upheld what the ECB said, that this was just wrongful removal. It didn't really adhere to the treaty. What happened next? I don't know. Latvia is continuing its sort of attack on Rimsevic. And of course I only met Ilmar Rimsevic a couple of times. I don't know if those allegations are true or not. And I don't know how you handle that. But what has happened for sure is that the removal from office has been very quick, very effective, and very much against the European treaty. Right? In Germany, well, the legal attacks against the ECB have failed, but they were very high profile, and they were on OMT and the Asset Purchasing Program. OMT, by the way, was never used. But it did help to calm down markets at the time. Now, we've had others, and I meet occasionally Yanis Tourmanos, and he tells me what is happening in Greece, why the Syriza government and the MPs are making his life really very miserable. And also, the way that he's been attacked is through his wife, right? They round up family members, and they do criminal investigations. I mean, this is very inventive and unbelievable. It's putting pressure on the governor, right? And it's not accidental. Italy also recently about, you know, the resignation of the senior deputy governor we've had because of political pressures. But then Slovakia is another country where the governor is resigning early because of political pressures. So there is partly this tendency that we want to populism. I'm not sure it's the right term, but certainly we've seen the rise of parties that show little respect for educated elites, they call us, I think. Educated elites. It's a common thing that tends to unite across the Atlantic, I think, a lot of people. It's not to do with left-right. It's more against things that we sort of hold dear, right? You know, we want analysis to be evidence-based, even if we disagree, right? We still want the policy sort of to be evidence-based and based on research. So this is what is happening, is rejecting the completely educated elites. We also have issues with other responsibilities in Europe. I don't have much time, but I can talk about that as emergency liquidity assistance. And what we've seen with the ECB itself is that Mario Mario Draghi, but also the person who is in charge of legal at the ECB executive board member, Yves Mersch, has published stuff and given talks about the independence. And basically his interpretation is that it only covers monetary policy. Anything else, because we don't have a clear mandate, not a clear objective, monetary policy, you have price stability, very easy to define. When it comes to financial stability, well, we're not sure. So that really has meant, actually, it's a signal. When you say that, the politicians would just go for that. Those who want to undermine the independence of the central bank will try and use that. They will not go for anything to do with price stability in the governing council. supervision, resolution, financial stability. Right. I talked quite a bit about Cyprus, and I don't know how much you know about it. I'm going to have four slides about the Cyprus crisis, partly because it demonstrates the importance of Minsky, I think. So, and why it's relevant? It shows the imperfections of the financial architecture that we have in place. Cyprus joined in 2004, the European Union, right? In 2008, it joined the euro. Of course, it liberalized the financial system, and what it had is a lot of euphoria, right, as a result. And underestimation of risks, right? People just didn't think of risks. They thought of the opportunities, right? And this is completely consistent with the financial instability hypothesis. But in practice, in what happened is that there was a service industry there, lawyers, accountants, bankers, and they actively promoted, they really went after Russian business, right? Russian and Ukrainian at some point, but mainly Russian. So Russians were looking to optimize their affairs. I'm trying to put this sort of diplomatically, right? as diplomatically as possible, right? And supervision of the banking system didn't change because, of course, we didn't have the SSM until 2014, right? And we did have the SSM partly because of the Cyprus crisis, but also other crises. So it remained as it was, right? I'm not going to blame our predecessor, right? But we just inherited the system, didn't change it. We tried once to introduce some macroprudential rules on credit expansion, and the parliament, all in its entirety, went against him, so he backed out. So risks were high, but they were ignored, basically. This is sort of the size of the banking system. It went up to 9 times GDP, and a lot of it was Russian money coming in and Ukrainian, right? So they call it, some people call this financial development, but this is also built up of risk, right? It's also built up of risk, huge built up of risk. And if you look at European rankings at the time, you see that Cyprus has the top two positions, Bank of Cyprus and Nike, and each bank 2 times GDP, the balance sheet. So you can imagine how much power, political power they had, right? This is one of the first things that I faced, the political power of Bank of Cyprus in particular. So this is the attempt for a Minsky moment, right? You can see bank credit to the private sector. And at some point it was highest in the world, right? Highest in the world. Okay. And this is a gamble for resurrection on GGBs, Greek government bonds, because NPLs were rising. People say that the Cyprus crisis was caused by the Greek crisis. Not just the tip of the iceberg, right? My analysis in the book is that the banks went for GGBs because their income dried up, because of NPLs that they were managing to hide. There's one takeaway to take from the Cyprus crisis is this. The GGBs were a symptom rather than the cause of the crisis. It was a trigger, of course, for the crisis. But they were a symptom of other problems. And this is the timeline of the crisis, and the second bullet point is the most important one, right? I had nothing to do with any of what you saw before, right? I was in the UK at the University of Leicester, professor, right? I did not even have a credit card from a Cypriot bank. I did not even have an account. Okay, so the rest is what actually happened during the crisis. And we had the agreement, the final agreement happened on 25th March 2013. And it involved the bail-in of bondholders, shareholders, of course, and uninsured depositors. And about 4 billion of uninsured money belonged to Russians. Right? So they were not happy. And the people who represented them were not happy. Turned out the people who represented them were the people in government. And it turned out the president's law firm, right? Mr. Anastasiadis' law firm was representing some of the Russians who lost money in the crisis. It turned out the vice president of Bank of Cyprus was a certain gentleman, Vladimir Strashkovsky, who was very close to Mr. Putin, but also a client of the Nikos Anastasiadis law firm. It's just facts. Turned out, right? So you can imagine why there was a need for a scapegoat, massive need for a scapegoat. And the Central Bank of Cyprus was a very convenient scapegoat. Partly because we gave ELA to Laiki, as if we could not give ELA to a systemic bank twice the size of GDP. What would have happened? We could not bail it in. We did not have resolution legislation at the time. So the only thing we were working towards is to give time to the politicians to find a solution, basically. But we were blamed for that. And of course, the bail-in in the end protected public finances. Why Cyprus has recovered so quickly from the crisis? Precisely because of the bail-in. If they had borrowed as much as was needed to bail out the banks, it would have been worse than Greece. It would have had higher debt-to-GDP ratio than Greece. Okay, so I mentioned about the scope of the independence. I already mentioned about Yves Marsh, what he said. And is there anything else? Here is a single supervisory board. If you look at that, it's independent only insofar as ECB members are concerned. So the non-ECB members have no independence protections, no independence safeguards. Right? And that's been part of the problem. Do they matter? Yes, they do matter, these setbacks. There's another example from Cyprus, the failure of the core bank that was in the hands of the current government. And although it was supervised by SSM, it was basically they exercised forbearance because the Central Bank of Cyprus asked them to do that, right? And they were trying to protect the government. They didn't want to do a failing bank just before the election. So Mr. Anastasiades got re-elected, and a couple of months later, the bank failed. Right? That's what exactly happened. And now there was an inquiry that actually showed that, a judicial inquiry. And, of course, the government tried to discredit it, but it's there, 800 pages. So small countries matter. Of course, I am from a small country. I want to say that they do matter. But if you think of money laundering, right, political money laundering, where would these guys go? They would go to the weakest link. Okay. And once dirty money enters, it would just go throughout the single market. Right? So that has additional implications. And I think erosion of central bank independence, as we've seen, is contagious. It doesn't stop. You can't say Cyprus is an isolated case, although you may have said that a few years ago. Okay, I'm not going to talk about it. In my new book, I have 6 recommendations how to fix the problems in Europe, but part of it is introducing fit and proper criteria for central bank boards. There's none, although we have them for commercial bank boards. There's none for central bank boards. A pan-European regulator for AML CFT, and Europeanizing emergency liquidity assistance, separating out SSM from the ECB, right, and removing resolution from national central banks, and of course increasing the presence and visibility of the ECB in member states. Commission has representative offices in each member state, the ECB doesn't. So at that point, I will.
Presentation will cumbersome and ineffective policy with substantial risk and consequences. So high time for a review and to very seriously look at where we stand as an ECB and as European citizens, I would argue. And time for a review that the ECB would not be an outlier in doing that, as I said, it hasn't done it since 2003. Here in the US, the Fed is doing the Canada review, the Bank of Canada is doing a review, and the Swedish Central Bank has done a review already. It's also a very unique and the right moment to do so. There will be a new ECB president appointed this year. I think the first task for that president should be to start that review. There are also eight NCB, National Central Bank, governors to be replaced this year. There are a lot of board members leaving shortly. So there's a lot of change at the ECB governing council, which is again, I think, a good moment to do that review, try to do it as objectively as possible. That's why I am in favor of appointing an ECB president outside of the circle of governing council members and outside of the finance ministers of the euro area countries. Somebody with a strong academic background, but knowing the system rather well. I still have 5 minutes, so that's my argument for a review. Then let me not very modestly put my cards on the table. But I'd like to see. I immediately say it's very unlikely that this will happen. I think in the broader context of reform outside monetary policy, I think the most likely outcome will be kind of muddling through, but in the direction of slowly further integrating. I think that's the most likely outcome, but we'll see. But a lot will depend also on the European elections that also will take this year in end of May. So what I'd like to see, let me mention 9 points very, very quickly in those 4 minutes that still remain. Adopt an inflation target with a range, so I'm not being overly precise. Reintroduce money and financial variables by including financial stability or preferably financial resilience considerations into the monetary policy framework. Most important thing that you have to do there is to lengthen the horizon over which monetary policy should achieve price stability. I would argue that we should agree on a minimum policy rate of 0.5%, explicitly stating that we will not go negative in the euro area. Monetary policy, QE, I would see that as a crisis instrument, not as a normal instrument of monetary policy, and only in situations of actual debt deflation as a threat to be used and not in normal circumstances. Back to limited access to the ECB, so no longer all liquidity resources making available. Back to only interfering short-term money markets. So that's my six points for the ECB. Now I add three that are outside of the ECB proper, and they are all highly controversial. Again, no chance of having this adopted, probably, but perhaps worth mentioning them. The first is that I'd like to see the Stability and Growth Pact and the macro imbalances procedure
professor, everybody always has a certain conflict of interest. You want your students to do well, but you're a little envidious when they do better than you do. And Lex is an example of this. And he's even gone beyond my expectations with his recommendations, which are even more radical than I am going to propose for you at this point. The title which I've picked today is Level Playing Fields of Flanders. You all know where Flanders is, I presume. It's someplace around Brussels, and we had things around there, and they had battles, and basically what we've been talking about is the battles that we have for the reform of the European system, and in particular the euro. Now, let's see if this is going to function. What I'm going to give you is a very short presentation of a recent experience of mine as an advisor to the Italian Minister for European Affairs after the election of the recent government. Those of you who are familiar with the political background, the Italian election produced a basic divergence between what we may call, I think generously, a right-wing party and a left-wing party. And it was presumed that a government could never be founded on this basis. In fact, they confounded public opinion by, in fact, appointing a government. And one of the linchpins of this political compromise was to be the appointment of a minister of finance who was not a member of either party and was considered to be, shall we say, a wise old man who I had worked for previously. Now, this wise old man had already formulated a project for leaving the euro and created a great deal of public dismay and a great deal of European dismay. So in the end, rather than having him as finance minister, they decided to appoint as the Minister of European Affairs someone who was formally on record as being in favor of Italy leaving the euro. At that stage, I was appointed as an advisor, and the objective that we had was, number one, to prevent the government from falling, number two, to prevent the government from proposing leaving the euro, and number three, providing some sort of reasonable explanation of what the government policy, in fact, was going to be, because it was not clear that the government did have any policy aside from what had been presented during the political campaigns as we're getting out. So what we eventually produced is this document, in which eventually it was marketed in a publicly available provision. And basically this was, and I'll tell you the end of the story by the way, this was because the government decided to drop the proposal completely, and the minister was invited to become the head of the Stock Exchange Commission, which is his current position. And my current position is, fortunately, I'm no longer required to advise the government on what it should do with the euro. As you can see, the document is drafted by the ministry to propose the creation of a high-level working group composed of representatives of member states, the parliament, and the commission, which will examine the correspondence of the current European institutional architecture and economic policy with the objectives of growth, instability, and full employment explicitly foreseen in the EU treaties. Basically, what we were doing was trying to say, well, it's obvious, number one, that Italy is not leaving. Number two, it's pretty obvious that most of the changes which would be required, which we would desire, would require some sort of change in the European treaties, which is a very long and complicated process, and something which would not alleviate the difficulties that were being faced both by the Italian economy, as Lex has already highlighted, and were being faced by the basically what the document does is to try and justify the necessity for the working group. And basically it's divided into two sections. And the first part, and this is the title of the idea of the level playing field. If we look at all of those conditions which Lex wants to get rid of, and I actively support that, the reason that they're there, and quite sensibly they're there, is because if you were going to introduce a single currency, which was very quickly recognized as an integral component of the Single European Act, and you're going to use this to operate monetary policy, it requires that you have at least a modicum of uniformity across national economies. And basically, this is what these conditions are meant to do. The convergence criteria, I'd say, is if I'm going to set monetary policy at 2% or 3% or 4% or whatever, it means that in general, the inflation rates in the economies have to be reasonably similar. It means that the fiscal stances of the governments have to be reasonably similar, and the debt positions of the government should be reasonably similar. So it made a great deal of sense. Everybody attacked these as being out of their logic, economic logic, but they made very simple sense on this idea of the level playing field. If you're going to have a single monetary policy, you're going to have a single currency, then everybody should be more or less similar if the policy is going to work. Now, the difficulty was that these things were, in general, not respected. And the idea was that these conditions, which were set out in the protocol, everybody knows the famous numbers, were interpreted as convergence. So if it looked like you were moving in the right direction, you were given the benefit of the doubt that, in fact, probably you would be more or less similar to what the other economies of the system looked like. Now, in Italy's case in particular, although Italy was moving in the right direction on a number of indicators, the indicators were widely outside of what was considered as being acceptable. And as we now know, there was, shall we say, help from Goldman Sachs and a number of other investment banks in order to arrange the Italian accounts in such a way that they appeared at least to be converging towards the European limits. So we start out by saying one of the basic ideas was this level playing field. It was a good idea. It was never, in fact, honored. And in general, there were a number of, shall we say, divergences which were created by, as I've already mentioned, Italy being outside the norms, and Germany after reunification, which allowed them to move substantially away from the European norms. Now, if we look at this in this aspect, we say the single currency was second area in which it is different is that the central bank design was something which had never been seen before. Basically, it was what in the old German case we called a Notenbank. It was a bank of issue. It issued the currency, but it was independent of any national government or any national government balance sheet, with the basic objective of price stability, which meant that you no longer had any possibility of direct coordination between national fiscal policies or EU-wide fiscal policies and monetary policies. These things were basically separated. So I would call this an institutional omission in the European architecture, which is basically what we've been talking about, how to fix that. Wynne Godley, a former distinguished scholar here at the Institute, very quickly had pointed out the difficulties that this raised when he talked about the Maastricht Treaty proposing no new institutions other than the European Bank. And he says this could really be correct if modern economies were self-adjusting systems that didn't need any management at all, but clearly this was not the case. So he pointed out that the Maastricht criteria for the establishment of convergence were far too narrowly conceived, and not narrowly conceived in terms of their values, but basically it looked like they were too narrowly conceived because they did not fulfill the conditions necessary for a successful currency union. It is not nearly enough that member countries agree to follow simple rules on budgetary policy. They need to reach a degree of structural homogeneity such that shocks to the system as a whole do not normally affect component regions in drastically different ways. Noting that if Europe is not to have a full-scale budget of its own, it will still have, by default, a fiscal stance of its own made up of the individual budgets of component states. The danger there. wants to end up, I'm going to put up a diagram, which is due to Rob Parenteau. Rob is here someplace in the audience, which he's developed. Rob rescued the 45-degree line diagram from its ignoble use by Hicks and Hansen to produce a very nice diagram looking at the various combinations of fiscal surplus, current account surplus, or sorry, fiscal position, external position, and private sector position, according to the famous fiscal balances approach of Wingodley. Now, what I've done in this diagram is simply to plot the various countries in terms of their positions. And to give you an idea of the argument, if you look, Italy is here in a position in which it has a relatively large private sector surplus. It does have a current account surplus. One of the reasons that it has a current account surplus is because its growth rate is so low. But if we look at the kinds of adjustments we would like, the idea is that this 3% line, there is the fiscal balance line. So you would like to have countries in the fiscal balance line. If you look at the fiscal surplus line and the current account surplus line, you see you have Germany and the Netherlands are there. And basically the argument I'm making is that if you look at the impact of the exchange rate, the euro exchange rate moves, and with moving the exchange rate will change that Ezeta number, the Ezeta, this is Eurozone, okay? And that will move that Eurozone number someplace in between current account surplus and current account deficit. The problem is that it also is going to change the position of all the individual countries. Okay, so that you have sort of an n-dimensional matrix here. And what we tend to be missing is by focusing on the Eurozone position, so the Eurozone has a net fiscal surplus, the problem is that if you alleviate that surplus, you say what we're going to do is to provide some sort of fiscal support that would push the Eurozone back towards the center of the diagram. In fact, all of these other countries are going to move and you have no idea which way they're going to move. And if, first of all, you don't know which way they're going to move, you have a political problem. And secondly,